Good morning. Today we're joined by Emmanuel Ashirifi, founder and CEO of Seeker, a financial market infrastructure provider that's focused on FX settlements across frontier and emerging markets. In global FX markets, settlement risk has in the main been engineered away. Payment versus payment, multilateral netting infrastructures like CLS, and robust clearing frameworks are taken for granted in most G10 currencies. But across much of the Global South, for example, and newer frontier markets, FX settlement remains fragmented, manual, and capital intensive, which can create hidden risk, trapped liquidity, and slow treasury and trade and supply chain workflows. So welcome, Emmanuel. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how it is that you came to come up with the proposition that is Seeker Financial Group.
Thanks, Tina. I might say that that's a very great introduction of what we do. And yeah, thanks for having me here. So I'd like to start off with how we got to the point of building Seeker. So in a nutshell, Seeker was created to address, you know, the settlement infrastructure gap within the emerging market, basically bringing the same confidence, trust, and matured market, you know, executions to, you know, the emerging markets and frontier markets. I've been very fortunate in my career early on to start working across matured market and then also developing markets. So I believe that gave me an early exposure to the gaps that these markets were facing. You know, that early exposure to, you know, how cross-border flows movements are orchestrated, how payment, you know, orchestration happened, the FX challenges within these markets. One thing I did see across most of the emerging markets over the years was a lot of the problem that fintechs and technology companies were solving early on were more focused around inclusivity, how people can have access to financial services and products, which led to, you know, a lot of payment processing companies, neobanking, etc., which was really great because it gave people exposure at a time that was where the emphasis of the, you know, market gaps and challenges were. But then, you know, as that was solved and as the market evolved, the bigger challenge or the bigger gap started getting exposed, which had to do with how liquidity impacts this market, how settlement finality can be orchestrated, the settlement bit, what happens post-trade. So understanding those gaps critically across those markets and also seeing how this was solved across matured market led me to building Seeker.
Thank you. That was enormously comprehensive. Looping back a little bit, I think it's quite important to put Seeker in concept. So the first thing to say is you're not an FX trading platform.
That is correct.
Well, I was going to say, and you're also not. So two things that you're not. You're not an FX trading platform and you're not a payments provider. Not a cross-border payments solution. So can you drill a bit down into that, where you actually sit specifically in the transaction lifecycle?
Absolutely. I'm happy you brought this up. So when you take a look at a transaction lifecycle, well, the first challenge or the first layer is the front end, which is basically how can I pay for products and services? So I want to pay for products and services, whether on local platforms or global platform, using the currency or payment method that I'm familiar with, and then also paying in my preferred local currency. So having access to mediums or, you know, ways to pay, whether I'm using card or I'm using, you know, mobile money or I'm using cash, that access to paying any global, you know, merchant or service provider or even local or regional service provider is key. That's one aspect. So that's where the payment processing companies focus on. So payment orchestration and all this stuff. Then the second aspect of the problem is once the money has been, you know, collected by the payment processing company or the acquiring bank, now the money sits within a certain country. So let's take a look at a company like, you know, Emirates Airlines, or they go to a market like, let's say, Argentina or Brazil and sell airline tickets there. Now, the user in Argentina is going to be paying for this airline tickets and services using the Brazilian real. Now, what's going to happen is for Emirates Airlines, they recognize revenue in AED, which is the dirhams, but to most, they could accept dollars. But, you know, let's use AED for this purpose. After the user has been able to pay for their services with their preferred payment method, in this case, let's say Pix, and, you know, the money is in the bank account in Brazil, in Emirates bank account, the next phase of the challenge would be how Emirates is going to move that money from Brazilian real to the AED. So this is where the trading platforms come in. You go and you do the FX, you know, exchange buy and sell, puts in your orders based on the volume, the exchange rate is applied, da, da, da. Then the third layer, which is what I call the backend, is where we come in. So whatever happens post that trade, when the trade economics have been agreed on, whether between two bilateral counterparties or even with a single counterparty, we then come in. And our role in the market is a central counterparty, basically offering all members or, you know, participants in the market the ability to be able to send their trade flows. And then we use methods like, you know, multilateral netting. We use PVP, which is payment versus payment, to eliminate counterparty risk. And then the multilateral netting helps to improve liquidity, because if the trade flows are primarily bilateral, it means you're more likely or most likely not to find counterparties to be able to execute. So all these, you know, mechanisms come in play for us to ensure that the money moving from the Brazilian real to the AED moves in a, you know, there's confidence and we are able to achieve settlement finality, you know, eliminating any potential risks for a counterparty either defaulting or the settlement not being achieved. So that is where we sit in the market.
Thank you very much. And to me, this is particularly the fascinating bit. Obviously, you know, we've talked about it. I've been on the edges of the FX market for many years. So I've seen the advent of electronic trading platforms and, you know, more efficiency brought to the trading element. But I think it is important to emphasize that that can happen. There can be all sorts of FX activity. There could be trade, finance activity. But fundamentally, at some point when the roundabout stops, there's a bunch of money sitting in a currency that a company may want to have in a different currency in order to repatriate it for accounting purposes, for business purposes. And you've given a really good example of an airline. I think we've talked previously about, you know, commodity providers or importers, exporters would be presumably a big demographic for you as well, because they have the same challenges. They're moving goods in and out of different countries using different currencies. They have to pay people in on the ground in different places. And at some point they may, well, they're likely to want to bring it back into whatever their base currency is that they work it, whether it's dollars or, as you've mentioned, Brazilian real or any other currency.
Exactly.
So I think the key is as well, it's a liquidity play from the perspective of the market participants. If they aren't using you, might struggle to either have a counterparty with whom they can facilitate this, or they're in a traditional correspondent banking relationship where they may not necessarily be able, because of illiquidity, to get the best rate to affect these transaction flows. Yeah. So going back to the reference you made to being a central counterparty, we will be very careful because you're not a central counterparty in the sense of the banker of last resort in this sense. But the magic of your proposition, as you referenced, is any activity is pre-funded by each counterparty. They come into you, they say, we want to do something, we want this currency, and we're going to pay you with that currency. And you, in turn, have other counterparties who say, we want actually to receive that currency. So that's quite fortunate. And you're effectively matching these counterparties through your platform. So there is no settlement risk. A, there has to be a match. You have to be able to fulfill the request. And B, you haven't got those counterparty credit constraints that would exist if these counterparties had to talk to each other directly.
Exactly, yeah.
Could you explain, for the benefit of our listeners, just sort of simply what the flow is from how people engage with you and what happens sort of through that workflow from front to back, beginning to end?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will like to approach it from the first step of how the flow even happens. Now, when you take the average user or member who is ideal customer for Seeker, these customers go through a series of challenges, which primarily within the merger markets and then the frontier market. Now, number one is market visibility. When you pick, you know, a commodities company or a corporate, one of the biggest challenges those corporates have is having, you know, visibility into the markets that they are either trading in or, you know, settling their flows from. And some of those challenges, like market visibility, can hinder those companies from actually, you know, moving funds and then also losing money or making capital less efficient. Now, if you pick the likes of large global multinational corporations, one of the biggest challenge they have is, in the same scenario I gave, they have money in another country, in another currency, whereas they need a base currency in another country, in the case of the BRL and then the AED. Now, what is going to happen is to move that money, they need to know how much is going to cost them to move. Now, when you're doing this in the matured market, it's very easy because, you know, you have access to tools that give you price visibility, etc. But then when you're doing this in the emerging and frontier market, well, it's not quite the same because you're going to have, you know, markets that are trading or two-tier pricing where you have the parallel market rate and then you have the mid-market rate. And, you know, sometimes the parallel market rates are so wide and so far from what the mid-market rates are. Now, that's one of it. Then the second thing, which I talked about, which is the counterparty risk and so on and so forth. Some of the markets are illiquid, so they're thinly traded currencies, so there's actually no depth in the market. Now, when you bundle all these challenges together, it actually, you know, creates a certain pattern that most of these businesses, you know, would like to follow, especially within the emerging and frontier market to execute their flows. And this is the learning that we have, or, you know, some of the research and learnings that we took into consideration before building our flows, right? So, you know, when a member or, you know, participant comes onto our platform, there are quite a number of, you know, steps or processes that we take them through in order for the trade execution happening and then the settlement happening where we come in. Now, the first step is we, you know, obviously we'll take them through the process of onboarding and, you know, approving the member. And then we go to the process of setting limits, you know, applying credit lines where applicable, and then, you know, setting permissions and also link their settlement bank account within the market status. So that whole process is where, you know, the member and participant is really onboarded and set up. Then the second stage is where, you know, the member submits their trade to us. So in the case of a corporate or, you know, an exchange or a bank, within this process, they're going to be, you know, submitting their trade either via APIs or, you know, direct platform or file upload. And then we go through the process of verification to see whether they are bilateral matches or bilateral transactions or match transactions within those flows. And then we also, you know, make sure that we create immutable records for this, timestamp everything. While in parallel, what we're doing is also, you know, concurrently checking the eligibility rules engine, making sure that we are checking, you know, the participant permissions, checking the member and counterparty limits, and then also checking the currency and corridors that they want to execute based on the ones we've, you know, activated them for, and then also checking them against AML and sanctions. So from that stage, we then, you know, run a quick risk evaluation before we go on to the actual real-time risk calculation, which is where we look at, you know, exposure impacts and then also net position simulations. So this stage actually tells us the netting efficiency we possibly would have, you know, running the settlement. And then we move on to the decisioning point. So this is all like the pre-check. So once we get to the clearing decisioning point, then that's when novation kicks in. Because then, you know, the bilateral agreements they might have with other counterparties would have to move to we becoming a buyer to every seller and a seller to every buyer, right? So from there, we become a counterparty to their direct obligations. At this point, we update the member positions. And then we use the multilateral netting calculation. We apply the multilateral netting calculation, and then we set the currency and corridor exposures within that same phase. And concurrently, what would also be happening, you know, in an asynchronous way is checking the market movement, because most of these markets are not, you know, the currency volatility is so high such that the market by every minute, every, you know, second is moving. And sometimes it moves in a very wide way. We keep monitoring the exposure drifts. We also look at concentration checks, checking the concentration within the flow. So we do this within cycles. And then from this state, you know, we move on to the actual settlement preparation, which is where the net settlement, you know, obligation calculation happens. And then also the liquidity optimization. So that's where if we have to optimize liquidity, we do that. And then the funding confirmations. So these are all very important stages to making sure that we match every transaction, and the ones that are even partially matched, we look at how we can prepare them, etc. We usually onboard market makers to match when the netted efficiency is high and all those things. So we have a couple of, you know, tools in our arsenal that we use to manage those workflows. And then from the settlement preparation, we move straight to the actual settlement execution, which is where the PVP, you know, is applied. So at that point, we are ensuring that all members, you know, have paid the obligation, and we check against the payment versus payment to eliminate, you know, the risks of somebody not having paid and then we having to settle that. So we take away that risk. And then the settlement bank and local rails are, you know, brought in place. So whichever settlement bank the partner is using or we are using, we ensure that now the money will be moving from those rails. And then also from there, we move on to the settlement confirmation stage, which is basically we confirm the cash movement, which is actual money moving from bank account to ensure that we can post that, give the settlement finality. And then also there's a final position update. And post the final position updates, we send, you know, a member confirmation report or member statements.
That was very comprehensive. And it sounds, if you were listening to that, you'd think, oh, that must take an awful long time. You referenced to a window, but for the benefit of the listener, you could put some timeline around how long this process in real life should and would take.
Yeah, typically, you know, this usually will take about, you know, a day at most to execute. So I know the process sounds like a lot and it seems like a lot is happening, but, you know, systems are integrated, you know, some of those things are pre-automated and the checks are, you know, automated. So it gives us a quicker turnaround time because, you know, you want to make capital efficient. And in this market, speed, not necessarily speed, but, you know, based on how the market moves, you want to make sure that you can provide, you know, the members some reliable locked in rates such that you don't keep moving at every, you know, second. Otherwise, it makes it quite inefficient to go back and forth on what has already been agreed on, and then they lose money.
Because it's probably worth reminding our listeners that the alternative could potentially be much, much longer, because if it's an illiquid currency, or, you know, well, that would be the primary reason, and there's just nobody who wants to transact at a price that's reasonable, then it could be longer, that it could be many days in that scenario, couldn't it?
Yeah, we've had counterparties or members who came to us couple of months ago and they were locked out of certain markets for more than 6 months.
Wow.
Because of illiquidity. Yeah. They went to the banks and the banks are like, well, we can do, you know, up to $10,000 a day. And these guys have millions locked in that market.
So I guess there is an element of land of the blind here, right? That if people can potentially make mileage out of those delays, then they might, let me put it that way.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is what makes capital efficient in this case.
But there's also, I believe, let's talk a bit about how central bank, you're working with central banks, because obviously there's many, many frontier markets. I mean, I could guess at the number, but let's say there's 50, at least for the sake of argument, across the globe, south and elsewhere. Does this require that you have to basically have an agreement with every single central bank to do what you're doing, to operate as you're operating? And or are the conversations around that you're subscribing to the FX Global Code and the IOS, you know, all the rules that surround PBP, and therefore they're already, if you like, assured that you have the right tools in place to do what you're doing? I mean, what's the dynamic with central banks? What's your experience of that?
I mean, the interesting thing about the market that we're focused on, which is, you know, the emerging and frontier market, is these markets are developing. So in that sense, you would find that, you know, not everything you require may be as it's supposed to be. So, you know, we've had several central bank dialogues. So, you know, we've had several engagements with quite a number of central banks where we are bringing that level of, you know, execution to the market. So through workshopping, you know, working on policies, and then also, you know, engaging them on structures that could be in place to, you know, help guarantee the success of, you know, infrastructures as such. And I would say that it's been overall positive, but overall, I would say that it's all part of the market developments because, you know, if you look at matured markets, it's not going to be the same conversation. And we've been invited by the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve Bank, to have conversations. They commend what we're doing for bringing such, you know, execution and delivery mechanisms for settlements to, you know, most of this emerging and frontier market. But then, you know, it takes a lot of work, obviously, to, you know, develop these markets, bringing PVP, the standards, even though we adhere to, you know, the principles of the financial market infrastructures, the global FX code and this and that and that. So yeah, that has been our experience, you know, so far.
I guess in any market evolution, that's a challenge because there's always an element of not invented here or let somebody else go first and then we'll see how well that works for them. To that end, are there any particular countries, currencies, which you would say are leading the pack in terms of having this enlightened view or being more embracing of developing this type of infrastructure, working with you or supporting what you're doing? Is there a particular group of countries or country that you would say are leading the way?
Yes, we met a deputy governor of the Central Bank of Ghana. Our reference the good work they're doing there. Very, you know, open to innovation, very open to, you know, maturing the market. And we did have really great dialogues there where we believe that, you know, obviously moving from that market to the other markets will be even a lot easier because then there's a reference point with a central bank for what we're doing. And one of the things I want to also say is we have, you know, one of the exchanges that is, you know, in the process of becoming one of our members, and they already engage and work with most of the central banks. And, you know, one of the things they highlight is this has become such a big topic across, you know, that world where, you know, some of the central banks even ask them if they could provide full straight technologies for settlement. Infrastructure, as we've known it in the last, you know, 2-3 decades, was primarily built for, you know, a small section of stable or matured market. And if you take all the structures, the principles that apply to such market, and you want to lift it to the frontier and emerging market, I'm sorry, it's not going to work the same way. So it takes, you know, people who understand the nuances of this, you know, frontier markets and emerging market. So for us, the engagements with the central bank is also, you know, a part to creating that unique execution tailor fit for those markets whilst bringing the learnings from this matured market. The emerging and frontier markets currently, as we know, still rely on, you know, much manual, bilateral and risk heavy processes, as well as, you know, the systemic risk and then the trapped liquidity and higher cost of executing in those markets. So, you know, the central banks themselves, believe it or not, are calling for a solution because then it doesn't help them in any way. Because think about this scenario, right? You're a central bank, you have your liquidity reserves in, let's say, dollars, and you are a net importer. So it means that you always rely on foreign exchange to buy the goods and services, especially, you know, oil and gas for your country to consume. But then you have a market that also needs to function where you have businesses, commodities, etc., that are looking to also trade with other partners in the world. Now, what that's going to do is it's going to put pressure on your foreign reserves because everybody's demanding the dollar from your market or, you know, whatever the stable currency in your market is, you know, especially if you're a frontier emerging market. Now, the challenge here is that most of these emerging and frontier markets, either, you know, backed by agriculture, produce, precious minerals, or, you know, some sort of raw material. So it's also very seasonal for people to demand their currency. So let's say if it's, you know, whatever, you know, wheat season or, you know, corn season or sugarcane season or tobacco season, then you'd find a lot more people demanding that local currency. But then what happens if, you know, it's out of season and there's less demand for your currency? So these are the things that cause the, you know, volatility on that currency. So if you have the businesses within your market, especially multinational businesses, also demanding the forex, you know, within your market, asking you to tap into more of your reserves, then it creates a much bigger problem for you. Now, what we are doing and what we're bringing to these central banks allows us not to take money out of the economies because we're using multilateral netting. So every settlement is more of like cross-market local settlement. So every settlement is localized. So if it's, you know, taking on city positions in, let's say, Ghana, all those city positions stay in Ghana. And if there's settlement position or obligations in Ghana, then it's just moving from another Ghana city account to another Ghana city account, whilst, you know, the forex reserve is basically, you know, preserved and the central banks can, you know, utilize their, you know, forex reserves for much more needed commodities or stuff that they need for the country. So this, in an overall way, brings the conversation with most of these central banks to a light where they begin to see that, okay, this is the direction of the market. This is actually where we should be heading towards. Yeah.
A really good point. I was going to ask you actually just to describe, and it may be that we've gone over some of this, who your target demographic is, because your client base or your member base is quite a broad church. And I think that's an important message as well that distinguishes you.
So first of all, you know, the demographics we're focused on, primarily frontier and emerging market, but then the ideal customers we work with are institutions, and these institutions who become members or participants on the platform are primarily multinational corporations or corporates, banks, and then, you know, other financial institutions who have, you know, such obligations across those markets. And then, you know, what will be the central banks in the future as, you know, we've started this engagements, and then also the exchanges, right? I think we have about 3 exchanges, I would say some of the largest exchanges in the world today engaging us for this market. Because when it comes to the matured market, yes, there are tools, there are, you know, solutions, the problem is already solved. And where the challenge currently is today is the emerging markets and the frontier markets where such tools don't exist. The ICP will be, you know, banks, global multinational corporations like commodities companies, logistics, energy companies, etc. And then also, you know, other financial institutions, so payment processing companies, sometimes remittance companies, we also work with them. And then also the central banks eventually, yeah.
So outside of the central banks, anybody who has a need to transform one currency into another in the most efficient way in an emerging market or in a frontier market where the traditional infrastructure doesn't exist, this is their opportunity. They can come and work with you. It doesn't alter their existing relationships. It complements, it augments the flows that they already have by providing that efficient, assured settlements that will enable them not to have to worry about why is it taking 6 weeks? When will it ever settle? So evidently, there are some other financial market infrastructure providers in this space. And I'm guessing, without naming them, that they could have extended the proposition that currently exists for the G20 on G10 currencies. They could have said, let's just cover the world, but they've chosen not to. Would your feeling be that it's because it's just not worth it to them in terms of the scale of the activity versus, you know, the G10 currencies, or they just don't see what you're seeing because they're not on the ground and they're not really seeing the change in many of these emerging markets, particularly the Africans, which again, driven coincidentally by a lot of the climate discussions that are going on. There's a lot more project activity, there's a lot of carbon credit activity. There's a great deal more interest, in my opinion, in some of these economies and countries than there might have been 10 years ago. And I think that's interest that's growing for the reasons that you outlined.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, you know, one of the things I want to bring to light is there's about, you know, from the recent China report from the BIS, there's about $9.6 trillion exchanging hands every single day. And out of that $9.6 trillion, we, you know, for what we know, about, you know, $7 trillion of that daily flow has PVP and, you know, this multilateral netting, you know, there are market infrastructures that help solve for this. And these are primarily the matured markets and a few emerging markets, right? One of just a handful. But then to the rest, which is, you know, over $2 trillion in daily flows that, you know, are orchestrated across multiple markets. Those don't have PVP or payment versus payment. So the counterparty rate is high and then there's no multilateral netting. It's mostly bilateral flow. So it becomes more expensive and it becomes time consuming and all these other things that, you know, come with this. Now, the reason why, you know, I personally believe most of those large global market infrastructure players haven't attempted some of this frontier and emerging market is their nuances. So I believe that, you know, it takes people or businesses that are bold enough like us to say, hey, this is what a market needs. Let's build from ground up, purpose fit for those market. And that is how this problem could be solved, not just retrofitting what exists in another market and, you know, patching it to somewhat make it work for another market. So we are building specifically for this market. And I think that's where the difference comes in.
I think that's a really, really key message, Emmanuel, because to your points, from a big provider perspective, their business decisions are based on scale and, you know, margins and effort versus return, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas you are going, having completely the reverse approach, which is standing on the ground saying, how do I build it for this? How to fit this particular, not retrofitting, but actually creating a bespoke solution that works for these particular markets. And it also, I suspect, means that you start with one, whether it's Ghana or Ghana and Kenya or whatever it happens to be. And then others will say, oh, this is interesting. Now we want to talk to these guys. So in terms of timing and so on, I mean, you're a fairly new business. I know you're building up a team of specialists, some of whom I know very well from UK. Certainly, I can't speak for the rest of the world. But in real life, what sort of the time span do you think you're doing business now, presumably? I mean, what's the strategy for 2026? What's the big priority for you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously starting 18 months ago, we've seen quite a lot within, you know, the closed loop go live we had. We've been very fortunate to have worked with some of the large global institutions, banks, some Exim banks, you know, to put in perspective, and some of the largest global multinational corporations. So we've actually rolled out the product, tested it, made sure this market fit, ran through the engines to ensure that everything works as it's supposed to. There's no room for error, right? So we had to, you know, roll out to a small sectional group of potential members that we believe fit, you know, the use cases. We tested edge cases as well. And now, you know, in 2026, we are ready for the big guns. And like I did mention or alluded to earlier on, you would see some announcements come up, you know, in the course of the year. Some of the largest exchanges in the world, about three of them, we have active engagements with, who will, you know, become members eventually. And then we have some of the large global corporates and multinationals that we've also, you know, are now beginning to open up for. So in a nutshell, 26 is basically trying to scale that. We've also had, you know, quite a number of central bank engagements where we believe that we should be seeing some collaborations and some other initiatives take shape in a few of this market. And the hope is that this sets the base for us to replicate and strongly push the narrative of bringing trust to this market, bringing confidence to businesses to execute their flows in this market. Because when you think about most of this market, the first thing that you think about is risk. We want to bring that horizontal layer that is missing from the market for all the market verticals to plug into, to say, hey, now this, you know, this trusted infrastructure, or this confidence we have in this market based on this, you know, infrastructure that we can move in and out of this and that currencies. And hopefully we scale that across, you know, the rest of the regions.
These markets have been underserved, and there is some negativity and perceptions that need to change, because I don't think it reflects today's reality. And we do, as you know, work in climate finance space, and we know this firsthand. There's an enormous amount of growth and activity and dynamism in many of these markets. And it is always and ever about narrowing that gap between the mature economies, the mature markets, and the traditionally less well-served emerging markets and frontier markets. I don't think I've mentioned, and if we haven't, we should also just explain what seeker actually means. What does seeker stand for?
Yeah, so seeker means money in Akan language in Ghana. Simply put, I'm Ghanaian, for those, you know, who might not have caught the accent yet. Yeah, and we sort of like acronymed it to mean settlement infrastructure for key assets. So in a nutshell, we're saying that, hey, what we're doing is connected to market, but then we're also primarily a settlement infrastructure for key assets, obviously starting with FX in this scenario. So yeah, that's primarily what seeker is.
Oh, that works nicely, based on the original meaning, given your cultural background. And in fact, it stands for settlement infrastructure for key assets. Well, we're excited to see what's coming in the year ahead. Emmanuel, thank you so much for your time. And we'll look forward to seeing all these big announcements coming out in the near future.
Yes, it's a pleasure. And thanks for hosting me.